This is Ms. Millis, the Bathtub Mermaid, and this is a special Halloween edition of Tales from the Tub. In this episode, I share three stories of the season: Lips, Under Glass, and The Ghost Waltz.
Nuke Jess recording Lips. Cat knew what he was the moment he walked into her pub. It wasn't anything obvious. His clothes were ordinary. No sign of a cape or decades of out-of-date ruffles and lace. His skin wasn't particularly pale. His soft brown hair held no sign of a widow's peak. And yet, there was something about the way he carried himself, moving through the throng of peak-time drinkers without coming into contact with a single one of them, that made it clear he was something special, something other. The crowd parted as he approached the brass rail. Jake, one of the regulars, put a protective arm around the shoulders of his young, legal, but barely, she'd been carded, blonde date. The pretty redhead on his other side glanced at the newcomer, shivered slightly, and slid off her stool. Cat saw her absently finger her neck as she disappeared, heading toward the restrooms. Please, be here with a friend, she thought. The stranger took the vacated seat at the center of the bar and fixed his brown eyes on her face. Points for that. Most of them, the ones that preferred women, anyway, got stuck on the jugular, if they made it past the tits. Cat found herself drawn into those eyes. They weren't the deep brown of black coffee, but warmer, like bittersweet chocolate. And his lashes. Most women would kill for lashes like his. Long, thick. If he was old enough to be a daywalker, those lashes would make the sunglasses that were de rigueur among his kind pretty uncomfortable. Still, to the untrained eye, nothing about him screamed bloodsucker. Sure, there was the inevitable sense of unease about him, but lots of paranormals caused that. Cat knew that this stranger, this man, was a vampire because of his lips. They all do it, she explained to one of her barbacks a few weeks before. Man, woman, doesn't matter. They do that thing with their lips, as if they have to consciously hide their fangs. It wasn't all that different from the way teenagers used to try to hide their braces, Cat reflected. They made their mouths a little wider, a little tighter at the corners. They did something with the upper lip to provide more space. And this guy had the perfect lips for one of his kind. They were textbook soft M-shaped. They were dusky pink, but not so dark that you'd think he just fed. The top one held a hint of felinity. The bottom one was full, luscious. Even better, he had just the right amount of dark brown facial hair. More than a 5 o'clock shadow, less than a full beard to accent that mouth. Yeah, Cat thought, licking her own lips. Definitely a vampire. And completely kissable one at that. She'd dated vamps before, of course. It was inevitable in her line of work. They kept the same hours, frequented the same spots. It was only natural. It was also dangerous, which is why she didn't do it often, and had established her own sharp precautions. Always take them to a hotel. Never their place. And never, ever your own place. Never let them pay. Never drink anything that isn't clear. Even a drop of their blood could put you in a thrall. And the one rule that some women, she knew, found difficult. Under no circumstances did you allow a vampire lover to be on top. At least not unless you were into being a pincushion. You have my vintage? Cat shook herself out of her reverie. Come again? She asked, as if the noise was what had kept her from hearing his question. His cheeks dimpled slightly, and he repeated his query in a voice that wrapped around her like velvet. Chocolate velvet. Bittersweet chocolate velvet. I asked if you were Cat, and if you have my vintage. She quirked a flirtatious eyebrow at him. Freshly corked. She reached below the bar for a deep green bottle with no label. Water, wine, or... Neat, he said. Please. She nodded and poured the slightly viscous red liquid into a stemmed glass. To the casual observer, he'd be drinking red wine. He lingered there until last call. Cat could tell that he was not only watching her, but also watching her watch him. Between customers, they chatted, doing the verbal dance that meant they'd likely be leaving together after last call. If Cat pegged him right, and she always pegged them right, he'd make a purposefully nonchalant invitation after the last employee disappeared out the back door. And he did, and she accepted. The night air was damp and chilly as they left the pub, invigorating. Walking next to him, she realized her head just crested the top of his shoulder. Perfect. My car's over there, she told him, indicating the parking lot across the street. I came on my own, he said. That was the euphemism his kind used when they'd flown or fogged from place to place. No problem, she said. I like to drive. She took him to a discreet boutique hotel that was halfway between the pub and her apartment. The night manager recognized her and handed over the key to her preferred suite. In the elevator, she handed him a breath mint, which he popped into his mouth without question or pause. There was no talking. She reached for the lapels of his leather bomber jacket at the same time he caught her by the waist. Kissable, she thought. So very kissable. His warm brown eyes glittered in the softly lit room. I know you're called Cat, he said, staring down at her. His dimples had come out to play again. My name is... Shh. She cut him off first with a finger, and then with her mouth against his. God. His mouth was exquisite. He tasted of wintergreen and danger, the faint tang of blood barely detectable. When finally she had to breathe, she favored him with another of her eyebrow quirks. I'll just call you Lips.
Under Glass. Read by Mark the Encaffeinated One. When Joe had finally agreed to spend the first weeks of his retirement remodeling their house, he'd assumed that Molly meant redoing the kitchen, adding the island she always wanted, and increasing the cabinet space. He'd never expected that he'd be renting heavy equipment and hiring contractors to demolish the garage in order to expand it and add a second story with mother-in-law quarters. He'd never expected that he'd be working with the guys he'd hired to haul away chunks of the cement that had formerly been the garage floor, or dig out a new basement. He'd certainly never expected to find a small, sealed coffin under the layers of mud and sand and concrete. A coffin that still held a body. Actually, it reminded him of that fairy tale his daughter had loved when she was younger. The one about the girl in the glass casket. The one who wakes up when the prince kisses her. Except this coffin wasn't made of glass. Instead, it was formed from lead and bronze, with a pair of diamond-shaped glass windows set into the top. And it was old. Decades, at least. Maybe centuries. Except this girl, the one inside the box, wasn't an adolescent on the cusp of womanhood. Rather, the pale face he saw centered in the top window, the one framed by jet-black curls adorned with a bit of lace, was cherub-cheeked and babyish, and he didn't think that she'd been a day over 3 when she died. Funny, she didn't look dead. She looked for all the world as though she'd been tucked in for an afternoon nap, the dark eyelashes of her closed eyes resting against the soft skin of those adorable cheeks, those pinchable cheeks. "You have such fat pink cheeks, Gracie. I'm going to eat you up." Joe bounced his 5-year-old daughter on his knee, laughing with the child as she giggled. "I'm going to stuff an apple in your mouth and roast you in the oven," he teased. Gracie howled with little girl laughter, understanding that her father was only teasing, and demanding to know, "What else are you going to do to me, Daddy?" "I'm going to wrap you up so tight." This was their bedtime routine. Molly was in charge of bath time and pajamas, but Joe handled story time and tucking in. Nighty-night, Daddy. Good night, Gracie. But Gracie wasn't a little girl anymore. She was 20, off studying at Tulane, with father-daughter bedtime stories far behind her. Still, Joe thought his own daughter had once looked just like this child when she was sleeping, peaceful, innocent, a little girl taking her afternoon nap. Only the white rose clutched in her tiny fist told a different story. The white rose and the nameplate on the foot of the box. He reached out with his gloved hand to rub the grime away. Edith, it read. No last name. Poor kid. He stared down at the girl under glass for a few more minutes before he realized that the sun had gone down and the men he'd found waiting outside Home Depot at 6 a.m. on Tuesday, the same men who had found their own ride out to his place for the 2 days since, had already jumped in their truck and gone home. He really ought to call someone. He really shouldn't just leave her there in the open. What if some kid wandered in? What would the neighbors think? Joe left the place that used to be his garage and went to grab a tarp from the back of his Jeep, noticing that Molly's Prius wasn't in the driveway. He wondered where she... Oh, right. It was Thursday. She taught at the adult school on Thursdays. She left a lasagna out to defrost. He was supposed to start it in time for dinner. Funny how physical labor made you forget stuff like that. He was about to swing the canvas cloth over the coffin when he caught sight of her face, found her fathomless black eyes staring at him from under the glass. Wait a second. Hadn't they been closed before? Joe dropped the tarp over the casket and retreated from the remnants of his garage. The back of his neck had that cold, prickly feeling, and it was pretty dark out. Better to get inside, start dinner so it'd be ready when Molly got home, and figure out who you call to report a dead child in a coffin under your garage floor. Was that something you dialed 911 for? Friday morning rolled in with a violent rainstorm, which meant no work in the garage. But while Molly was upset about the delay, Joe was relieved. He hadn't told her about the coffin. His wife was prone to having nightmares, and he didn't want to be the cause of another sleepless night. He'd waited until she left for work. Then he'd called the emergency line after all, because, really, who else would know what to do?
"Sir, this isn't funny," the operator informed him. "We have a major storm causing flooding at the low-lying intersections, and we can't afford to waste time on pranksters."
"I'm not a prankster," Joe had insisted. And either she had sensed the anguish in his voice, or she had a friend she wished to twit, because she'd referred him to the county coroner, instructing him to
ask for Charlie.
It turned out that Charlie was actually Charlene, and she was also convinced it was some kind of joke. Joe had gone out to the garage with his smartphone and snapped some pictures, texting them to the cell number she'd provided. 2 hours later, a coroner's van arrived, and a red-headed woman who appeared to be in her early 50s joined Joe in the torn-down garage, flanked by a ferret-faced man who said he was Jasper from the Historical Society, and a woman in a conservative skirt and veil, the contemporary habit of a nun, who said that she was from the Sisters of Innocence, and explained that her organization would handle the burial at no charge.
"Mr. Hunter," the coroner greeted him, "I'm Charlie. We spoke on the phone. I'm so sorry. This must have been quite upsetting for you."
"It was definitely a surprise," he replied affably enough. "My wife doesn't know."
"I'm not surprised you found a coffin," the Historical Society rep interrupted. "From the photos you sent, yours is about 150 years old. The whole area was a cemetery then. The bodies were relocated around the turn of the century, though. Ground's too wet. Coffins kept floating to the surface."
Joe had no way to respond to that, so he ignored it, except to say, "It's not mine." And then, "It's here, under the tarp." But Jasper continued,
"She clearly came from a wealthy family. Lead, bronze, glass. This thing was built to last."
Joe turned his back to Jasper. Charlie did the honors, removing the drape, and the three adults all looked out the window at the still, small form inside. Her eyes were closed again, or Was it still? Joe saw, but her mouth looked a little different. The lips seemed redder and plumper. Or maybe he was just imagining things.
All right, the coroner said. Jasper, if you'll give me a hand moving her, we'll get going. I think Sister Celeste has some paperwork for you to do, sir.
The nun had been murmuring a prayer over the casket, and she took a moment to gaze through the window before allowing Joe to direct her toward the house.
Such a beautiful child, so well preserved.
It's because the coffin's sealed, Jasper said. No air, no deterioration.
Joe decided he didn't care much for Jasper. Joe Hunter had never been a great cook, but he figured if he was going to tell his wife what had been removed from where the garage used to be, he'd better ply her with food and drink first. The morning's rain had left a clear, crisp night in its wake. Chilly, but not too cold for barbecue. He had a pitcher of margaritas mixed and the steaks ready to go on the grill as soon as Molly arrived home. The cold pricklies came back at about the same time his phone rang. Charlie from the coroner's office, calling to tell him that something had happened. Happened? Joe had no idea why she was calling him.
When we got to the morgue, when we opened the casket, the child, she was gone.
Joe had no idea what to say, but it didn't matter because Molly walked in just then carrying a white rose and smiling like she had on their last anniversary when he'd given her that string of red pearls.
Do I smell charcoal?
She asked and lifted her face to his for a kiss.
Yeah, he said. I thought we won't have many more nights warm enough.
He thumbed the phone to an inactive state and set it down on the counter, face down. Margarita?
Perfect.
They ate and laughed, and he finally told her about the coffin and showed her the pictures.
It almost looks like her eyes are open in this one, Molly observed.
Joe agreed that it really did. They went to bed early, but they didn't go to sleep because Molly was reading a chapter of some novel on her Kindle, and he was using his iPad to send an email to Gracie.
Come home for Thanksgiving break, he requested. Your mother and I both miss you.
Around midnight, after Molly had turned off her light and rolled on her side to sleep, Joe got up to check the house. It was his ritual, one his father had performed long ago. Make sure all the doors are locked, prep the coffee maker for the morning, hit the bathroom one more time. He was passing Gracie's room on his way back to bed when he heard it. Soft, so soft it was quieter than a dream. A lick of childish laughter. The kind of laughter a 3-year-old might produce.
The Ghost Waltz, read by Melissa A. Bartell. Dance me, Pop-Pop, I beg, wrapping my whole hand around just one of his thick, calloused fingers. Aren't you getting too big for this, sweetheart? He teases, but I know he doesn't really mean it. I shake my head, my golden brown braids whipping back and forth. Never, I answer, followed by, please. Being winsome has always been a special talent of mine, and as a 5-year-old, I'm at my peak. All right, he says, and he envelops each of my hands in one of his and helps me balance while I place one of my bare feet on top of each of his sturdy shoes. I love his shoes, his work shoes, he calls them. I know he has shiny wingtips for when we go to Sunday brunch at the officers' club, but his everyday shoes are made of brown leather and have thick soles, and sometimes Grandmom has to remind him not to track dirt all over her clean floor. He always answers her with the words, yes, dear, half-spoken and half-sung, and she can tell he's not really listening, and when she swipes at him with a dish towel and scowls at him, we all know she's really saying, I love you. While we dance, he hums a waltz that is as familiar to me as the way purple-striped cotton sheets feel against my suntanned skin when I slide into bed after my bath at night. I don't know its name. You're my super special sweetheart, he tells me as we sway in circles around the dining room. I love you, Grandpop, I reply. Hours later, when I'm playing with blocks underneath the baby grand piano and I stand up too quickly and bang my head, My grandfather is there, gathering me into his arms and drying my tears with a white cotton handkerchief. He holds me in his lap and hums the waltz then, too. Dance with me, I ask. My grandfather wrinkles his unruly eyebrows. You don't want to dance with your old grandpop, he protests, but he doesn't really mean it. It's my sweet 16, and he's rented the hall at the officers' club for my party. My mother and grandmother are across the room, pretending not to watch us, and my father, well, he's never been part of the equation. Yes, I do, I insist, and I really do mean it. All right, he agrees and heaves himself out of the captain's chair he'd claimed hours before. I glimpse the folded newspaper with the crossword puzzle hidden under his empty dinner plate, and I grin, but I don't betray his secret. The DJ pauses the endless list of pop songs to play the waltz I'd requested earlier in the night. Apparently, it's a standard song for father-daughter dances, but I still don't know the title of the tune. I don't ride on my grandmother's feet anymore. Instead, I follow his lead as we swirl in a graceful circle, and I smile when I hear him humming along with the song. When the music ends, he strokes my hair. "Thank you, sweetheart," he whispers. My answer is a gentle kiss to his whiskery cheek, just after I breathe into his ear. The answer to 15 down is Zephyr. Got enough energy for one more dance, Grandpop? I ask at the party to celebrate my grandparents' 50th wedding anniversary. He's danced with Grandmom and my mother, my aunts, and all my cousins, but I wanted to be last. I think I can manage one more, he says. The waltz, our waltz, is slow enough that he can manage it, but his steps falter, and I have to take the lead. To his credit, he allows it, and if there's any sense of indignity, he never lets it show. When the music stops, he kisses me on the forehead. You're my super special sweetheart, he says, his voice still strong inside a weakening body. The old endearment makes me misty, and I bury my face in his lapel. He smells the way he always has, ivory soap and aqua velva, and somehow it seems vitally important that I memorize his scent. At his funeral, I watch my mother and my aunts go to the coffin and stroke my grandfather's silvery hair, but even though the body lying there in state looks like him, his essence has long since left. I hold my fiancé's hand so tightly that he loses feeling in it, but he doesn't complain. Instead, he pries my fingers loose and wraps his arm around me, holding me close and offering me a cloth handkerchief. Sometimes I think I fell in love with him because of those cloth handkerchiefs. I'm half convinced he and my grandfather are the only men who still use them. Used. I correct my own thoughts. Used. My fiancé uses hankies, but my grandfather used them. Back at the house, after, while everyone is exchanging memories and trading stories, I slip away from the group and go into my grandfather's den. I curl up in his ancient leather chair and fiddle with the photo cube on his desk. The invitation to my wedding is pinned to his corkboard along with the photo of my fiancé and me standing in his garden. My proposal had come as the love of my life and I were helping my grandfather pick tomatoes. The old man had helped set it up, arranging things so I'd find the ring box tucked in against the fragrant vines. I open the drawer where I know he stashed those tins of hard candies, lemon usually, but sometimes coffee-flavored, and find a wrapped package with my name on it. I know I should wait, but it seems like he wanted me to find it, so I tear the tissue paper apart. It's a CD. The track listing has one tune circled in black Sharpie, and I don't even have to put the disc in the player to know it's our waltz. For the first time, I learn the title, and I have to smile through my tears. It's called The Ghost Waltz. I play it obsessively for the next 6 days until I, too, know it well enough to hum every note. Then I pack the disc away until I need it again. Mom and Grandmom look worried, but my partner understands. It's the night before my wedding, and there's a full moon shining brightly over the officers' club. The base is closed now, and the facility has been turned into a hotel and event center, but the owners are longtime friends of my family, and they've made sure our group is the only one in residence. My almost-husband is asleep in a bed so tall I have to use a step stool to climb in it. We've been living together for over a year, so sleeping apart seems silly and contrived. And I know I should be sleeping too, but I can't get my grandfather's waltz out of my head. I'd wanted him to be at my wedding. I'd wanted him to dance that waltz with me. I slip into my wedding dress and stare at my reflection in the mirror. I'm in my 20s now, but I swear I still see the echo of 5-year-old me in the oval glass. Maybe it's the song in my head, or maybe it's the moonlight, but I leave our suite and pad barefoot down the grand staircase to the main ballroom. There's a figure waiting in the center of the parquet dance floor, and my breath catches in my throat, because the perfect posture and slight paunch could only belong to one person. As I approach, the moon shifts and the figure solidifies. He's wearing a tuxedo, but his work shoes are on his feet. "Dance me, Pop Pop," I demand, using the words of my child self. His calloused hands wrap around mine, and he helps me balance one of my bare feet on each of his shoes. We hum the waltz together as he spins me around the room, and when we get to the end and my feet are on the ground again, he pulls me close for a hug that smells faintly of aqua velva and ivory soap. "You're my super special sweetheart," he says, his voice rough and ethereal at once. "Always," I respond. The clouds cover the moon, and I am left alone in the darkened room, surrounded by bunting in my wedding colors. I sink to my knees and start to cry. And suddenly I'm in bed, and my fiancé is soothing me in hushed tones that turn first to soft caresses and then to kisses, until, in the first hours of our wedding day, we're making tender love on the soft white sheets. Hours later, it's time for our first dance as a married couple, and my husband, takes the MC's microphone and makes an announcement. "For most of her life," he says, "my wife had another man. Another man in her life, her grandfather. He was her mentor and teacher and best friend. She was his sidekick and student and princess. They shared a song that they used to dance to. Last week I found a CD on my desk with a track marked in Sharpie and a post-it note instructing me to dance to this when you marry her. Well, I've married her, or more accurately, she's married me, and now we're going to dance." He returns the mic to its rightful owner and returns to my side. "I love you," he tells me. The music starts, and I'm immediately touched and teary. Resting my head against my husband's chest, he smells like cashews and fresh apples while we dance. And when I start to hum along, he surprises me by doing the same. "What's the song?" you ask. "Isn't it obvious?" It's the Ghost Waltz. The Bathtub Mermaid, Tales from the Tub, is written and produced by Melissa A. Bartell and is recorded and produced using the Boss Jock iPad app and Audacity. It's licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 International License. In this episode, Lips was read by Nutschuss of Nutty Bites. You can find her at nimlos.org. Under Glass was read by Mark, the Encaffeinated One. You can find him at encaffeinated.ca and theweirdshow.com. The Ghost Waltz was read by me, Miss Melis, the Bathtub Mermaid. Music used in this episode is Ghost Dance by Kevin MacLeod, courtesy of the Free Music Archive. For active links, transcripts, contact information, and more, visit bathtubmermaid.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, never invite a vampire into your home, and never, ever let your bathwater get too cold.